This is Artist Stories, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County. I'm your host, Ava Romero. Today, I'm with Lisa Hustrider-Lamb, Executive Director of the Mini Time Machine Museum of Miniatures and an artist in her own right, painting, drawing, and working in mixed media. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you, Ava. I'm happy to be here.
Lisa, first off, could you describe the Mini Time Machine to us? For someone who's never been there, what would they experience starting with walking right up to that enormous front door?
Well, I think it transforms you instantly. You come into what a lot of people call their happy place, and we are a really magical museum in so many different ways. The museum has a collection that dates back to the 1700s, as well as presenting work from contemporary times. We have three different galleries. One is designed to engage children, but the child in all of us really enjoys it. It's called the Enchanted Realm, and it has fantasy-themed miniatures and a magical tree in the middle of the room. And in that magical tree lives a fairy who will fly down and greet children when they come around to see her. In addition to the Enchanted Realm, we have our World Gallery, which features 20th century miniatures predominantly from the United States as well as Europe. And then we have our Historical Gallery, which has miniatures dating back to the 1700s, as I mentioned. And those pieces are primarily from the United States and Europe as well. We also have temporary exhibits that we feature throughout the year. And then we have a community corner where we feature exhibits by local artists. One thing that's really wonderful about our museum is this is a special place in Tucson because across the country of the United States, there are really only three museums that feature miniatures. There are a few museums like the Art Institute of Chicago that have some in their collection, the Thorn Rooms in particular there. But as a museum of miniatures, we're just one of really three.
I love reminding people about some of the gems that we have in Tucson, reminding people that they really are world class.
It's so true. Miniatures are a really unique art form, and they cover so many different kinds of topics, and it's not something that a lot of people are familiar with. So having the opportunity to experience that here in Tucson is really special and unique.
So how did Tucson come to have this fantastic Museum of Miniatures?
Well, our museum was founded by Pat and Walter Arnell, and they were miniature enthusiasts who retired here in Tucson in the late 70s. And when Pat came to Tucson, she had always collected small things, and she decided to pull out her childhood dollhouse furnishings. And when she took them out, she needed a house to put them in, and she wasn't quite sure where to begin, so she went to the antique stores, and she found at an antique store a dollhouse that was similar to the one she had had as a child in the 1930s. So she purchased it, and she took her childhood dollhouse furnishings and she furnished the dollhouse, but it was pretty sparse because she didn't have that many furnishings. So she thought, I need to create more things, and she was a very crafty person, always trying different kinds of craft. So she discovered that there was a miniature museum in town, and she went over there and learned that not only could you purchase pre-made items, but you could take classes and learn how to make miniatures. And that got her started creating and collecting miniatures more formally. And soon she and her husband got involved with the National Association of Miniature Enthusiasts and the International Guild of Miniature Artisans, and she became an avid collector. And as Pat likes to say, her collection got a little bit out of hand. And over 30 years, she amassed a collection of over 250 dollhouses and room boxes. And she had outgrown her house and built a workroom and a display area nearby that she shared the collection with to local groups in the community, like Red Hat Lady Groups or the local miniature club, or you know, anyone who was interested in coming to see it. And she noticed that people really loved it. And she was happy to share her passion for miniatures with the public. As she got older, she started thinking about what was she going to do with her collection. Her children liked certain pieces, but they didn't necessarily want it all, and she really wanted to share it with the bigger community. She also was really concerned about the fact children in our world today were becoming less involved with arts and crafts, and she wanted to see young people creating and making miniatures too. So she started thinking seriously about opening a museum so that she could share her collection and encourage future generations to not only enjoy miniatures, but hopefully make miniatures.
I love that story because it's one person's passion project that turned into a whole museum that's an institution for Tucson today. So how long ago was it that the Mini Time Machine was opened?
Well, we opened in 2009. We'll be celebrating 10 years this coming September, and we are very excited about that. So with our 10-year anniversary on the horizon, we're going to have a community celebration on Sunday, September 1st, and that will be free and open to the public. And at that time, we're actually going to be closed the last 2 weeks of August because we're going to be doing some refreshing in the galleries. On September 1st, when you come in, you'll be able to see some brand new things. We'll have some new interactive spaces, in particular, an exhibit on scale in miniatures, learning about mathematics and how that's applied to the hobby and the art.
Lisa, if I may ask this question, in your opinion, what kinds of people are drawn to miniatures, do you think?
I think there's really something for everyone when it comes to miniatures. They've really been a part of society and cultures around the world and throughout time. That's part of the reason for our name. The Mini Time Machine is a reflection of the way miniatures have been used in cultures as early as the Egyptians and through the centuries. People have used them for religious ceremonies, for enjoyment, as toys for children, as a fine art hobby. There's just so many different ways that they've been utilized. People who love craft are just amazed by the craftsmanship that they see, that somebody can make something so little and so perfect, have it looks just like the real thing in the real world, but be so much smaller. People who love history love learning about how cultures, because their houses are rooms, they demonstrate how people lived in the past. So people can learn about different cultures by looking at miniatures and exploring them. And then there's a fantasy element, because it's miniaturizing the world. You can create any kind of world you want, a fantasy world, like a dream castle or a fairy castle, which we have both of in our museum. Or you can also represent the real world, create a building that actually exists on a small scale, so people who can't get to that building can come to the museum and see it, or see it in a different way.
It's a bit of time and space travel there. I'm wondering about some of the contemporary artists that have been featured at the museum. For example, the last time we spoke, I was really captured by the story of Salavat Vidai, the Russian artist who was part of the exhibit On Point, Sculptures on the Tips of Lead Pencils.
That was a really exciting exhibit. It was the first time that the museum featured micro-miniatures. So most of the sculptures on the tips of those lead pencils were, as you can imagine, and you think about your standard number two pencil, which most of them were carved from, they were like a 16th of an inch tall and about the same in width. And Salavat Vidai was an artist. He grew up in a family of artists. His mother was an artist, and he went to art school for a couple years, but then decided that it wasn't quite his thing, and he went into business, and he ended up working in the world of business, and he was very successful. But though he was monetarily successful, there was a part of him that felt a little empty. And one day he happened to be in a park, and he ran into an old friend who knew him back when he was an artist. And the friend said to him, "So do you still make artwork?" And he said no, and all of a sudden he had sort of like a flood of realizing why he was feeling empty, because he realized that creativity was lacking in his life. And so he kind of had a midlife crisis in a way, and he decided that he needed to start creating again. But interestingly, prior to this time, he had never worked on a small scale, but when this happened, what he started to do was to paint paintings on seeds, like sunflower seed size, and apple seeds. And he wasn't quite sure why he gravitated to that, but that's what he did. And then it led to carving the tips of lead pencils. And one thing that he found about this practice is not only was he being creative and expressing himself, but it was very meditative. And as he worked, he started to get a sense of peace and fulfillment. And so it was really rewarding for him. And he talked to his family, and he decided to leave business completely and pursue his art. And they were very supportive. And he started to share his work on social media. And all of a sudden, people loved it and were amazed by what he could carve on the tip of a lead pencil with an X-Acto knife. And pretty soon his work started to sell and he was able to make a living. And now he's really creating a name for himself. He's been featured on various international companies, like Starbucks did some ads with him, and a variety of different companies have done that. And so we were very fortunate to have the opportunity to work with him to exhibit his pieces. And even more fortunate because we were able to purchase a couple of his pieces for our collection.
They must be so delicate.
They really are. Framing was nerve-wracking. We took him to a framer. The framer had him for a little while before they actually put him in. Our registrar went over the day that they attached them to the frames to make sure that nothing happened and that they returned back to the museum safely. But now they're secure in the frame, so the public will be able to enjoy them.
Could you maybe tell us another story about a remarkable artist who the museum has featured? I mean, I knew there's so many, but I was really hoping that you could tell us a little bit about Ray Matterson.
That was one of our earlier exhibits, one of the first traveling exhibits we had, and we borrowed his miniature embroideries from the William Louis Dreyfus Family Foundation. And Ray is such an interesting guy. He has a really unique story. So he grew up in Michigan, and he had kind of a troubled childhood. He was the son of an alcoholic, and you know, it just led to troubles later in life. He became a cocaine addict, and as a result, landed himself in jail. While he was in prison, he really started to reflect on his life, and he wanted to rehabilitate himself. And he was sitting in his cell and he was thinking about his grandmother and what she did, because he spent some time living with his grandmother when he was a child. And he remembered how when she was relaxing, she would always be embroidering. Well, here he is in a prison and he has no access to anything. But he gets the idea that maybe he could try that. If she could do it, why couldn't he? So he cut a piece of his bed sheet. He took the Tupperware that he had and cut out holes to make an embroidery hoop, basically with his Tupperware dish, and got permission to get some needles. And then he didn't have any thread, so he unraveled the threads of his socks, because he had tube socks with different colored stripes. And he started making little embroideries. They were only about 1 inch by 2 inch. They were little narrative embroidered pictures about his life. First, he did embroideries about his childhood and about his parents and his grandmother and, you know, just different events in his early life. And then he started to create embroideries about his more recent experiences, his experience with addiction. And the interesting thing was all the other prisoners started to learn about him doing this. And he was afraid that at first everybody was going to, you know, he's in prison, so he was afraid he was going to be beat up. But he had someone who said to him, "Would you embroider this particular thing for my girlfriend on the outside?" And he did it for him. And so then this guy was like his protector, and he was a guy with a reputation. So it kind of made him appreciated by all the other guys. Pretty soon they were saving their socks for him so he could have thread. So it was really amazing. And the embroidery process, he'd sit, you know, that's all he had time. He had all the time in the world to do that because he was in prison. And he just kept embroidering. And he learned about a woman on the outside who was able to help him get some shows. And he started exhibiting his pieces while he was in prison. And pretty soon people learned about it and they started purchasing his miniature embroideries. And Ray continues, he's out of prison and for years now, and he continues to embroider and sell his work. It is a challenge for him, but he has remained clean, and he credits the embroidery and the miniature art for saving his life.
I should mention his book if anybody wants to look into his life story a little bit more. It's called Sins and Needles. I love that Mini Time Machine has a community corner that you mentioned, which features local artists who work in miniature. Could you tell us about a local gem that you've featured?
We encountered a gentleman who was retired from Chrysler, and he was an automobile stylist. He did that for 30 years for Chrysler. And of course, working in the car industry, he was a car enthusiast. And his particularly favorite car is the Bugatti. and he collected a few die-casts of those. Well, once he retired from Chrysler, he had a lot of time on his hands, and he was used to keeping his hands busy. So he started thinking, you know, I love Bugatti, and the creator of the Bugatti died at a young age in a car crash. What would have happened if he had lived? What would have happened to the design of that car that I love so much? He had a particular model he loved. And so, as an automobile stylist, he thought, you know what, I'm going to make a miniature version. I'm going to make a model of the Bugatti, but I'm not going to just recreate it. I'm going to think about what would have happened next, and I'm going to design the next stage. So he came up with his version of the future, the next generation of the Bugatti, and he created a couple of these miniature cars on the 1/32nd scale. They are amazing. When the museum opened, he heard about us and he contacted us and he brought one of them in to show us, and we were so impressed. So when the community corner opened, we gave him a call and said, would you like to come down with your Bugattis and share them with the public? So we recently exhibited his pieces, and they were just stunning, just amazing.
I was also particularly surprised when you mentioned to me how many of these miniature items actually function.
Oh yeah, it's amazing. The not every tiny thing that you see functions like the real world, but many of them do. Those artisans who are really meticulous will take the time to make sure that if there's a lock on their little toolbox, that lock works, and there's a little teeny tiny key for it. And a lot of times these miniaturists won't be able to create it without making a tool that will allow them to create it. So there's all kinds of innovation going on in order to be able to recreate something small.
And also the different types of skill sets necessary or that are brought into the process. When I was there at the museum with you the other day, there was an exhibit that involved a lot of soldering.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit about that exhibit?
Yes. Our current exhibit, Borrowed Time, Borrowed Books, is an exhibit featuring the work of Jill Orloff, a Baltimore-based artist who creates miniatures out of metal. And she does most of it using steel tubes and rods, but she also combines other kinds of materials. So in this particular group of works, she decided she wanted to interpret libraries and talk about the issue of books and learning in our culture today through her miniature artwork. So she started to study 20th century film and television and look at how pop culture has interpreted the libraries in their power in our society and their value in our society. And she chose a selection of 6 different films and or TV shows that demonstrated that.
Lisa, could you tell us about some of the ways the Mini Time Machine makes itself more accessible to people and families with different budgets?
Well, first of all, we try to make sure that our general admission is very reasonable so that it doesn't surpass the price of a movie ticket. We want to be sure that people can afford it. But we also offer a lot of special deals, and we participate in some programs that provide free or nearly free admission to the general public. So, of course, we have memberships at our museum. In addition to our memberships, we participate every summer in Blue Star Museums, which offers free admission to active duty military and their families. And we also recently joined Museums for All, which is a national program established by the Information Museum and Library Sciences Organization. And with that program, if you have a SNAP card, just come to the museum and show that at the admissions desk, and you will get in for $1 per person. We also participate in the Act One Culture Pass, so you can go down to the library and check out a pass. We also have a program called Sizing Up My World, which is a mini grant program for school groups and social service organizations. And you just turn in a simple application, and you can receive free admission plus a stipend toward travel.
That's great. So there are ways to be at the museum a lot in the air conditioning in the summertime. Speaking of accessibility, we talked a little bit about how certain people with disabilities really are drawn to the miniatures in the museum as well. Mm-hmm. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we have a very exciting ADA program. And it started because we had an interest in wanting to make it the museum more accessible to people with vision impairment. And so we were looking at ways that we could do that. And knowing that navigating space is an interesting challenge when you can't see, and to really understand what a building is like is hard to comprehend. So we created a touch house that doesn't have a roof. And you can get down from above with your hands and feel around to understand how rooms fit together and how the different textures and so on. Some people with disabilities need to be very tactile and need to have their body engaged in their visit. We thought it'd be a wonderful tool for them to utilize on a visit. And so we do make that accessible as well, or available as well to all kinds of groups, but particularly for the visually impaired and those with other kinds of disabilities. And I think too, there's something about miniatures that we all can relate to. It's familiar, and yet it's small, so it's manageable. It makes the world, makes you feel a little bit more in control of the world, maybe. And so for those who might find the world overwhelming, it may be an oasis where they can comprehend a little bit at a time, and it allows them to work at their own pace. One other segment of the population in terms of disability is people who are starting to have problems with memory. So those with dementia, early stages dementia or early stages Alzheimer's, seem to really enjoy engaging with the museum. And many times when they see the mid-century pieces that we have, those pieces that represent the mid-century or even the antiques, it sparks a memory. And because their mind is often in another time zone, it helps them to relate, and it'll get them to be able to speak where they might not be very verbal otherwise. It's just really fulfilling to see people's eyes light up and to see them come to life when they've been sort of mentally isolated because of what's going on. Annually, actually twice annually, we have a program called My Time at the Mini, where the museum closes to the general public and we invite people on the autism spectrum to come and enjoy the museum in private so that they can be very comfortable and relaxed about any concerns that they might have while exploring the museum. We also make some adaptations to our show because we do have different effects in different areas of the gallery. So we try to adjust those elements to make it a little bit more comfortable too. So our next event will be the last Sunday of July.
A question for you as an artist, Lisa. How do you think that working with the Mini Time Machine has perhaps impacted your art or your artistic process?
Oh, I think it definitely has had an impact on me. I'm doing a little bit more mixed media work, and I've always been someone who loves art and crafts. I'm an oil painter, and I work somewhat traditionally. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's super realism, but it's generally very recognizable. But working in this world of fine craft and exploring different scale to interpret ideas and concepts definitely has influenced me in a way so that my current work, I'm introducing a little bit more craft and elements into it. I'm currently doing a series of Milagro pieces where I've taken what we know of as Milagros here in the Southwest, and I've blown them up to 18 by 24 and used them as frames for drawings that I'm doing. It's not something that I had tried before, but I think being influenced by seeing how craft can have a artistic depth to it, it started to make me think about the frame around my work in a different way. I took a miniature painting class last summer at the International Guild of Miniature Artisans Guild School, and I had never worked on a 2 by 3 inch paint, like a full, we were painting a peacock, an old traditional peacock, and the paintbrush I was using was a Zero. And I was expecting to use like a paintbrush with two hairs on it, and I get in there and it's like, no, we use like ones and zeros. I'm like, okay, so how do you get those teeny tiny fine strokes? And it was so frustrating. Here I am with a master's degree in painting and 20 plus years of experience, and on Wednesday of that week I was in tears because I couldn't make those fine lines. And part of it was just learning how to hold the brush properly. And then the next morning, I figured that out, and I was able to do it. But so it's interesting, you know, now I have a new skill set. I know how to do things on a very tiny scale. So you never know, I might explore that a little bit more in the future, too.
One last question What advice do you have for people who might be interested in joining the world of museum work?
Oh, I would say that if you have a passion and interest for museums, do an internship or volunteer at a museum. That way you get an idea of what the day-to-day is like. I think we all have romantic visions about what people do in museums. And if you work as an intern, then you understand what it's like. You'll get a little taste for it. You'll get a little experience. And also, I would take courses in the area of interest that you have. So if you're interested in the fine arts, a Bachelor of Arts in studio or art history, coupled with internships, will give you just that edge that others might not have. Also, as a volunteer, I should say, we actually have several staff who started out as volunteers at our museum. So volunteering is another great way if you're older, you know, and don't want to go back to school, and that's not really an option for you, but you think you might want to work part-time or even full-time in a museum. Because you get your foot in the door and you get to learn what that museum is about, you get to know that collection. And once that happens, then that opens up a door and an opportunity when a position does come available to you that matches your skills.
This has been Artist Stories with Ava Romero, featuring the stories of artists and arts organizations in our region. To listen to more podcasts, visit kxci.org. Artist Stories is a project of the Arts Foundation for Tucson and Southern Arizona, which is partially funded by the City of Tucson and Pima County.